Okay, we'll go ahead and get started. No, outside of electrical engineering, it's been a crazy past 18 to 24 hours for people. Hope everybody's doing all right. Got some more waiting and craziness to go if you're following the election. If anybody needs anything, feel free to reach out to me. But we will hop in with lecture for today. A couple of announcements I forgot to mention last time on the midterm exam. My policy is I'm not going to post written solutions for it. Hopefully gave you enough feedback on your graded assignment. If not, or if you have any additional questions or would like to go over how something should have been solved, feel free to come see me in office hours or schedule something anytime outside of office hours and we can go over any of the problems. But I don't plan to post any solutions for exams. And then the second bullet, so we've got the current site visit coming up. We'll have Industry Day on Friday and the NSF site visit on Monday. Those don't start until 10:30, but that is a big long day of presentations for everyone. So what I'm planning to do, unless anybody dissents, is we'll cancel lecture during lecture time this Friday, so next class, and Monday of next week. And what I'll do instead is post some recorded lectures on supplemental content related to prototyping and the tiny box challenge, things on layout, magnetics design, some additional information on the FPGA platform and how it can be easily incorporated into PCB layout. And those will all be kind of optional, things that won't show up on any exams or homework, but may be useful, particularly if it's first or one of your first times building a PCB for a power electronics application. But won't have anything required during the class time. Those will be for you to watch on your own time. Any thoughts or differential preferences on any of that? Then, if not, we will hop in. Okay. So, last time we were going through these different cases of charging a capacitor, looking at just select subcircuits with kind of this link to how this is going to be used in a power converter, but formally just looking at charging the capacitor through a simple circuit. Found that with a voltage source charging a capacitor, we're going to end up with these fixed charge sharing losses, which are just proportional to the square of the amount of voltage change we have on the capacitor during that charging. Okay. That's on the assumption that we can really complete that charging, saying that the time that we are charging the capacitor from a voltage source is much greater than whatever the RC time constant of that circuit is, such that this exponential kind of goes to zero or goes to its final value. And we'll relax that assumption today and look at what happens if we don't meet this inequality. Okay. But then we also looked at alternative cases. Okay, if we charge from a current source, we can end up with significantly lower losses. Instead of getting this exponential spike of current, we just have a constant DC current delivering the same amount of charge. As a result, we'll have lower conduction losses in the resistance of that charging path. So we've got an expression that looks like this, where this purple box is some scale factor proportional to RC over TC. And under the assumption we made in the voltage source case, that's less than one. So we get a lower loss here. Resonant, similar paradigm. Okay, we get lower losses because we're charging through now having a current, an inductor in the current path and allowing a half sinusoidal current. So I have much lower RMS for the same amount of charge delivered than this high peak exponential spike. both the current source and resonant type charging then just looked like some RMS current through a resistance. We're easier to solve that way. This voltage source type charging, while we could have solved it that way, really has to do with the change in voltage. So we went back and then using this did a little bit higher integrity analysis of this 2-to-1 switch capacitor circuit, solved for the power losses due to this charge sharing and the input power of the circuit, and then plugged in and ended here last class. And okay, looking at our power loss and our input power, we define this C-fly SFS product as some conductance, inverse of it, some equivalent resistance. Then our equivalent circuit for all of this is just our ideal conversion ratio for this converter before we considered any of these charging mechanisms. If we just assume all the caps are a constant voltage, we got that this was a 2-to-1 converter. So we get a transformer with that ideal conversion ratio. And then our loss mechanisms can be encapsulated in this equivalent resistance called RO, which was this REQ. And as we reflected over to the output, we got the turns ratio squared in the denominator, so REQ over 4. Okay. The numbers in here are all dependent on this being this 2-to-1 switch capacitor converter. In general, for any of these switch capacitor converters, if we change to a 4-to-1 or something else, we'll get a similar equivalent circuit. We have VG, some ideal conversion ratio. And some output resistance connected to our output port. The only difference will be what is that ideal conversion ratio will depend on the topology. And then this RO will be some different value. General N due from the ideal conversion ratio assuming lossless zero ripple operation. Then RO is gonna take a little bit more effort to find. In general, RO will look like some kind of K over CFS, but this K will depend on the topology and some additional analysis what this scale factor is. And we'll look at using really charge vector analysis to find that a little bit later, okay, for a generic switch capacitor topology. Okay. So this circuit model really, say, only charge sharing type losses. Charge sharing is the energy just associated with charging and discharging these capacitors. So we have no COSS overlap gate. Inductor coil, well, we don't have any inductor at the moment. So for all this analysis, we haven't even considered the existence of COSS. All of our switches have been ideal, safe, perhaps having some resistance associated with them when they're on. But they switch ideally and have no output capacitance to get to this model. If we want a more accurate model, we'd have to go back and consider COSS type losses. Overlap losses will not exist in the form that we've modeled before. Previously, we modeled these as the switching behaviors of a MOSFET when we're in a bridge that has a constant current held at the output and a constant voltage at the input. Here in this 2-to-1 converter with no inductor, we don't have anything holding a constant current. It's going to look like resistive switching rather than inductively loaded switching. So there still will be some overlap type mechanism, some loss associated with it not immediately jumping from being on to off or vice versa, but it won't be having a constant current until such a time as we can go through the Miller plateau. Instead, the voltage will be able to change at the same time that the current's changing. We're not locked into this clamped overlap type switching loss. Okay. So there'll be something there. It won't follow those equations from previously. Okay. But generally we have almost no switching type losses, even though these charge sharing losses really are switching type losses in some sense. But modeling just the charge sharing type losses for any switch capacitor converter will get some circuit that looks like this, an ideal conversion ratio and some output resistance. And again, there is no means for regulation. So N in this K will just be constants with respect to any sort of control variable. There won't be a duty cycle showing up in this transformer turns ratio that allows us to adjust the conversion ratio. It'll just be fixed based on the topology. We can slightly change the output voltage, but only by adding more losses to the circuit. Okay, so next I wanna take the same 2-to-1 converter and make it so that we can leverage some of this current type charging that we analyzed. And the way I'll do that is to just put a big inductor right here. LF, that I assume is some filter type inductor that'll hold a constant current over one switching period in steady state. Right. So if we put that in, consider kind of both of our two sub intervals, hop back and say, okay, here in this circuit, we've got these two devices, the top one and the third one on, charging the capacitor through a loop that goes like this, through the top device, through C-fly, through this third device into the output. Now putting an inductor, we'll put an inductor kind of in series with C-fly here, so it'll get charged by that constant current. In the discharge interval, that inductor will be in between C-fly and the output. So it'll get discharged by that constant current from the inductor. So in both sub intervals, we're gonna have constant current type charging and discharging. Okay. In this interval, it'll be getting charged. In this interval, it'll be getting discharged because the polarity of the current with respect to C fly will flip in these two intervals. Okay. So with that, we should end up with this type of a loss in each sub interval. So we'll have two sub intervals and both of them will have this 1/2 C V2 minus V1 squared times 2RC over TC loss associated with them. Okay. So we now have current source type charging and discharging. So we'll say that when we operate in this manner, the total energy loss will look like whatever we get in the first subinterval and whatever we get in the second subinterval. We'll just plug in the equation from our previous table. So the equation was 1/2 C V2 minus V1 squared times 2RC over TC. And TC will be whatever the length of the two subintervals is at the moment. We'll just say they're 1/2 C V2 minus V1 squared times 2RC over T1. And then in the second subinterval, 1/2 C V2 minus V1 squared, that's 2RC over T2. Okay. Because we're charging and discharging with the same current, switch capacitor mode will set T1 is equal to T2 is equal to TS over 2. We'll just kind of give equal time to charge and discharge. If that current holds constant, that'll give us the same amount of charging up and charging down of the capacitor and put us in steady state. So plugging that in, T1 and T2 are both TS over 2. And then our E loss will come down to just one term. These are both the exact same thing at that point. So I'll have C V2 minus V1 squared times 4RC over TS. Okay, and what I'm going to do is take this C here and add it here. So I have C squared times 4R over TS. And then this term here, C times V2 minus V1 squared. It's equal to, well, where did this come from? C V2 minus V1 was the total charge that went into the capacitor during that interval. And C times delta V is the change in charge. And we can write a different expression for that change in charge. It should just be the integral of the current during that subinterval. And we know that the current is a constant. It's equal to whatever IL is. So this would be IL times TS over 2 squared. So now our energy loss, if I replace that in there, got IL TS over 2 squared times 4R over TS. My power loss is equal to E loss times FS. So my FS will give me an additional 1 over TS. That'll cancel everything here. My 2s get squared and cancel with the 4. And I'll end up with IL squared times R for my total power loss. What is R? In this case, R is whatever the resistance in that charging and discharging path was. Assuming kind of some nominal resistance is present in either interval, it'll look like 2R ons plus resistance of the inductor plus an ESR of the capacitor. So in either subinterval, this current would have to go through the inductor, so we'll get an RL, it goes through the capacitor, so we'll get its ESR, and then we either go through this top device and third device, or second device and fourth device. Either way, we get 2 R-ons in series. Okay, so whatever the total resistance in that path is, in this case, happens to be the same in both subintervals. I don't have to worry about any difference. So what does our total loss look like? It looks like just the conduction loss of any converter of this type. Okay, so it's output current squared times whatever the equivalent resistance is of all of the switching stuff. Okay, so this we've called a hybrid implementation of a 2-to-1 switch capacitor converter. We took our ladder type converter where everything was switching in this certain pattern. These two devices on at the same time for half the period, these two devices on for the other half of the period. Had a 2-to-1 conversion ratio, and we just put an inductor at the output to allow it to get a little bit lower losses. Okay. This thing, depending on where you look at it and where you're coming from, was called a whole lot of different converters, though. This is also a 3-level buck. Also sometimes see it called as a 2-to-1 flying capacitor multi-level converter. Or FCML is flying capacitor multi-level converter. Look at it as a low frequency limit on a resonant converter. It's kind of can be seen as a lot of different things. Okay, so if we're thinking of it as a switch capacitor converter and just putting LF at the output, then it's a 2-to-1 converter and we just get a little bit lower losses. If we're thinking of it as a 3-level buck converter, now with this inductor in place, we can start to change duty cycle and actually change the output without lossy regulation. So now regulation is possible. Duty cycle, because this flying capacitor is no longer shorted to the output and then shorted between VG and V. It's not forced to go to those voltages. It's not forced to be a 2-to-1 converter anymore. This inductor decouples things and allows us to do some duty cycle regulation. So that's current loaded. We can also do the resonant implementation to get this resonant type charging characteristic. There are a couple of common ways to do that. The first would be to stick with what we had and make this inductor resonant such that LR and Cfly resonate at the switching frequency. We continue switching at 50% duty cycle. In this case, ILR would look like this. Here are average output current, IL, same as in this previous slide. Okay. So now it gets this sinusoidal rectified type characteristic. We'll have all of our switching actions occur right as it hits zero, which can be advantageous for reducing some remaining switching losses. This current can be problematic in that it's got a lot of harmonics due to this rectified sinusoidal type characteristic. It's a sinusoidal current, but in this rectification process, we're going to get a lot of additional harmonics. Those higher order harmonics can cause additional losses in the inductor. So another approach is to put the inductor here, call this LR2. And we can get really the exact same behavior of the converter, but the inductor current itself would then be a full sinusoidal waveform at the switching frequency. Again, our switching actions will occur near the zero current crossing. If we want to maintain some nice low current switching and these resonant waveforms, then we need to switch at 50% duty cycle and directly at the switching frequency equal to the resonant frequency. Again, like in the previous case, we could start changing duty cycles and switching frequencies, get some regulation out of this, but we won't have these nice resonant waveforms with low loss switching, zero current switching in it. Okay. Sometimes we may shift the switching frequency slightly to go from zero current switching over to zero voltage switching. We allow this current to go a little bit below zero or switch a little bit above zero, have more bias things towards zero voltage switching or zero current switching by slightly changing the frequency away from the resonant frequency, like we saw in any of these AC link converters. Right around the resonant frequency, we transition from zero current type switching to zero voltage type switching. Again, figure out if we actually have it, we need to look at the actual include COSS of each of these devices in a similar manner. So there's implementations of each of these types of switching. Generally, current loaded and resonant will reduce losses compared to just the hard charged case. but at the expense of having to add this additional element, either a large filter inductor or some small resonant inductor that has a small inductance, but potentially difficult to design since it's got a high frequency, high amplitude current flowing through it. So we'll have to design to really reduce the AC losses of that element. So trade-off there. We have kind of, to the moment, some nebulous barrier between these two that, okay, these hybrid and resonant implementations should reduce losses compared to the pure switched cap case. Assuming that T sub C is much greater than RC, or the time constant of the circuit, and we're operating in that regime where all of our analysis of this hard charging applies. Okay, so what I want to talk about now is where is exactly that boundary and what happens if you violate that. And canonically, that's what's referred to as the slow and fast switching limits within a switch capacitor converter. And we'll see what those are in a moment. First, I just want to talk about, okay, what would happen if I'd stick with just my switch capacitor converter, no inductor, and I start reducing that T sub C charging time. So again, the circuit that we used to analyze that was this switch thrown at T is equal to zero, some resistance in the charging path, charging up some capacitor C. Where B sub C of T is equal to zero is equal to V1. And then instead of just making the assumption that I let this thing charge until it gets to V2, I'm gonna look at what happens at various times. So I'll say V sub C of T is greater than zero. Looks like V1 plus V2 minus V1 times this exponential function. Minus e to the minus t over RC, t over our time constant. And so as time progresses, I'll follow this exponential. If I let time go very far, then I'll get this full V2 minus V1, or full delta V plus V1 gets me to V2. Okay, but if I don't let this go for a nearly infinite amount of time, then I'm going to get just some segment of this exponential function. And so let's see, V sub C from V1 to V2. So our original waveforms looked like this over TC. And I'm going to plot additionally the current I sub C, and I'm just going to normalize it by whatever the peak is of that current. So in this case, I'd have some exponential decay with a peak normalized of 1. Okay, so this will be my case where my T sub C is much longer than my time constant. 4, 5, 6, 100 times as long as the time constant of the circuit. And I can say that my final voltage is approximately V2, but I want to look at now some different cases of that. So we'll start here, T sub C over tau, and just do a table of what we get. And I'm going to look at the ratio of this charging time to our time constant versus the ratio of VC at TC, where our capacitor voltage goes, minus V1 over V2 minus V1. And here's our kind of delta VC actual over delta VC ideal, or delta VC when this inequality holds, T sub C is much greater than tau. Okay. So, you know, if this is approximately infinite, then we get 100% over here. So if my T sub C is much longer than tau, then at the end of this charging time, VC of TC is V2, and this fraction is just one. Okay. If I start reducing my T sub C, my charging time, or increasing tau, either through higher resistance or higher capacitance, then I'm going to start to get different waveforms over here, where, for example, my exponential rise doesn't actually complete within this TC time. And we haven't really arrived at approximately just a constant value. On the current, since I'm normalizing, it'll still start at one. It would actually potentially, even if we changed, depends on what we change, if we increased resistance to get to this different ratio of TC to tau, I'd have a lower current. My current will kind of decay, but not really make it all the way. Okay. Say this one is original here. T sub C is greater than, let's say, 10 times tau. Say this waveform is something like T sub C is equal to 3 tau. If I have TC equal to 3 tau, I get something like 95% plugging in and evaluating here for 3 time constants. And if I keep going, say I do something like 1 tau, just 1 time constant, waveform would look something like this, something like this. 1, what I get is 63% of the change in voltage, meaning what I actually got here, delta V, is 63% of V2 minus V1 in the ideal case. And as I keep going, say I do so half and 1/10. Half of a time constant, I'll get 39%, and 1/10 of a time constant, I'll get 9.5%. If I keep going, I'll get less and less voltage deviation. Okay. This 1/10 case, I'd end up with some small kind of exponential rise here. I can't necessarily draw real accurately. And because the voltage doesn't change much, I've got a constant V2 minus V1, I'll get nearly a constant current over this whole interval. Okay. We're just getting some fraction of a time constant of this exponential decay. This green waveform would be an exponential, but it's all way out to the right after we've already switched into the next subcircuit. Okay. So, okay, what I'm trying to motivate with this, well, if we look at this bottom plot, as I start to switch much faster than the time constant of the circuit, meaning a small T sub C relative to tau, I get something that looks almost like our constant current case, but without putting an inductor in there. Okay. Because I'm switching before I can get through even a single or a fraction of a single time constant of the circuit, I don't get much exponential decay on my current. And it more or less looks like it's just constant over this entire interval because it hasn't had time based on the RC dynamics of the circuits to decay. Okay. So in these cases, it's going to look more like constant current charging, look more like what we derive for current source charging. It's going to be more or less a constant current during all the subintervals because we're switching way faster than this RC time constant. And this is this concept of slow and fast switching limits. Okay, so slow switching limit what we call SSL means T sub C is much greater than tau. We call it slow switching limit and fast switching limit because both are really asymptotic behaviors of the circuit. A slow switching limit, TC is much greater than tau. We let TC become very big with respect to the time constants of the circuit. We can use the analysis we did previously where we just assume that this voltage makes it all the way to V2. The current decays all the way down to zero. Fast switching limit, FSL. Occurs when T sub C is much less than tau. We get through 1/10 or less of a time constant. And in this case, we're going to assume that the current doesn't change at all. The current stays constant through this interval, and the delta V here is negligible. Everything just stays constant, and it really looks more like a constant current type of charging. And there will be some area in the middle that's a little bit nebulous that will resolve by approximation, or we're kind of in this, you know, T sub C is pretty close to tau, where we get some exponential change in voltage. We'll kind of approximate that as continuous between these two limits once we look at and compare them. Okay. So let's just take the same switch capacitor converter and look at the FSL model. Okay, what would happen to this converter here if we assume there is no inductor and we just switch much faster than any of the time constants of the circuit? Okay. So we're going to say is, I'll sketch here the voltage VC fly. And say, assume T sub C is much less than RC, or time constant. Then instead of being this exponential rise, exponential decay, shark fin type VC fly, instead, what we'll end up with something with a more or less triangular current. Because the current going through the capacitor looks like in these two subintervals kind of come up and have some small exponential decay. Then we'll switch into the other subinterval of negative with some small exponential decay, and so on. This more or less looks like a square wave. So we can approximate IC fly as just being some constant value during each of these subintervals. Plus or minus whatever the output current is during that interval. If we do that, assume this thing switches in this manner, half the switching period in subinterval one, half the period in subinterval two. Say, okay, under this condition, what is the output power? The output power should look like an output voltage times an output current. Output current is the, let's just say, average of whatever current is going to the output, 0 to TS. Consider the output as being the lumped output capacitor and resistor. So assuming that this current stays constant, what is it during each of these intervals? Hop back to the equivalent circuit. Okay. So now what's happening is our current is limited by whatever resistance we have in each of these equivalent circuits. R, put it anywhere in this loop, R. So during subinterval one, we're going to have VC fly or V fly, it's approximately constant. There's very little ripple on it since we're switching much faster than the time constant. Output voltage is constant, input voltage is constant. So we just have VG minus V fly minus V across this resistance R. So that expression of voltages divided by R is the current that goes through to the output. The second subinterval, we've got V fly minus V applied across this equivalent resistance, that current going to the output. So when we evaluate this integral, IO is equal to VG minus V fly minus V, where this resistance R, which as we said, in the current loaded case, like 2R on plus R, ESR, the capacitor, will be the same in both intervals. We'll have that current for the first half period plus V fly minus V over R for the second half period. Given that these are the same, we can add them together. This looks like, that's why, excuse me, for my average output current, I should add a 1 over TS out here. So that 1 over TS will cancel out my 2 TSs. I'll have something over 2R, and it'll look like adding these numerators together, VG, I've got a minus V fly and a plus V fly, so those will cancel. I'll get minus 2V over R. And I can just divide this 2 through, say this looks like VG over 2 minus V over R. So that's my output current. My output power is that times V. Looking at this expression, what does it tell us? It says we've got an equivalent circuit that looks like VG over 2 get my VG over 2 minus V is the voltage applied to some resistor R. So I've got a resistor between that and V. This circuit gives me that same behavior where R is equal to 2R on plus ESR the cap. No inductance here. No inductance in the circuit, so I don't need RL. Still same equivalent resistance in both subintervals in this converter. So what do I get is I get something that looks just like what happened when I put an inductor in there, but all I did is just start switching much faster in the converter so that I no longer allowed the capacitor to fully charge and discharge. And now I got my resistance down. Instead of being this 1 over C fly FS due to charge sharing losses, it looks just like the conduction losses of the circuit in any normal PWM operating mode, just the resistance of the circuit. Okay. So combining these things to, missed a slide somewhere. Excuse me. I need to add a slide in here. Go. The behavior combining these two limits together, slow switching limit and fast switching limit. I'm going to look at, in either case, we had a circuit that really followed the same equivalent format as some transformer and some output resistance. Okay. Here in the fast switching limit, our ideal 2-to-1 plus a resistance that was just the R on and ESR of the circuit. Back in the 2-to-1 switch capacitor, in the slow switching limit, we had this equivalent resistance that looked like something having to do with C fly FS instead of the actual R-ons and ESRs of the circuit. So here we have something that varies with frequency. This equivalent resistance in the slow switching limit will get smaller as I go up in switching frequency. When we get to the fast switching limit, I just have some constant resistance. It just has to do with the R on the ESR of the circuit. So we have our RO when we're in the slow switching limit looked like 1 over 4 C fly FS. Our RO in the fast switching limit, this looks like 2R on plus ESR of the capacitor, whatever the actual resistance in that loop is. And so I'm going to plot these two on a Bode type plot. So I'm going to do log frequency for the x-axis, and then I'm going to say this output resistance of the circuit on the y-axis. Okay, what does it look like? I've got two asymptotic behaviors. RO in the slow switching limit proportional to 1/1 switching frequency. Plot here, kind of Bode magnitude. So that 1/FS will give me a minus 20 dB per decade slope. This is my magnitude, RO SSL. I don't have any imaginary components, so I'm just taking 20 log of that expression. Okay. RO and the fast switching limit has no dependence on frequency. It'll be something like this. Just some constant value. And okay, this point where they cross, let's call it F sub X. F sub X occurs whenever these two things are equal. Let's say 1/4 C fly F sub X is equal to RO FSL. Will occur when fx is equal to 1/4 C fly ROFSL. ROFSL is normally what we just called capital R, whatever our resistance in the charging path. And kind of say here, okay, if we invert both of these, 1/FX be our switching period, which would be equal to 2 of what we call these charging times for the circuit. 2 subintervals, they're both TS over 2. And that's equal to 4 C fly R, dividing out, say, to T sub C is equal to C fly R. At FX. Wherever they cross. Meaning, okay, right at this point is when my charging time is equal to the time constant of my circuit. Okay, so what that allows me to do is say, okay, where on this plot are each of these limits valid? So my RO SSL, this was 4 T sub C much greater than tau. This is 4 T sub C much less than tau, which means on this plot, my ROSSL really is valid somewhere back here. My ROFSL is valid somewhere up here. And then in the vicinity of this crossing point, really neither of these approximations are valid. Right at FX, T sub C is equal to tau. And neither much greater or less than will be a good approximation. Okay. Plotting it on a Bode plot, so the inclination would be to say, okay, this is a corner on a Bode plot, it should be 3 dB above. That's not exactly accurate here. That 3 dB rule comes from saying I've got something that I'm plotting that looks like 1/ an imaginary number plus a real number, and when do those cancel out, I get 3 dB from the 1/√2 of taking the magnitude of that complex number. So here I don't have any complex numbers. I'm plotting something that's entirely real and something else that's entirely real. So formally we can't say this is 3 dB up. However, we're gonna do it anyway. People have shown that that's a pretty good approximation. So we're gonna kind of connect through here and say we're just 3 dB up. What it's doing is saying then our total RO looks like the square root RO SSL squared plus RO FSL squared, which will make this a continuous plot across this FX, okay? This is approximately equal to, okay? That's not actually true. We'd have to go in and analyze what happens when the time constant is close to the subinterval time of the circuit. But people having done that numerically and gone through an integrated, they say it's reasonably close to just this approximation. Okay. Okay, so now we've got a continuous output resistance, and what can we learn from this plot? Okay, well, what we would like on this converter is to have the output resistance be small. That's our loss mechanism. Small resistances are better than large resistances when they're in the current path. So what this is telling us is you'd really like to always switch faster, right? If I'm operating somewhere right here, I start switching faster, my output resistance will drop, and it never increases on this plot, okay? So first conclusion, higher FS reduces RO and therefore P loss. So let's just always switch at higher and higher switching frequencies. Okay, obviously there's some limit to that, and it's that we haven't looked at switching losses in this, COSS type losses or overlap losses, as I said earlier. So if I start switching at gigahertz, those losses are going to dominate and the thing's going to be terribly inefficient. Fortunately, this says there's some breakpoint, right? So as I get close to this FX point, I start to get diminishing returns from switching faster and faster. So I'd really like to push the switching frequency up for whatever capacitance and resistance I have until I get in the vicinity of this knee. And then most likely I want to stop pushing up any higher because the incremental increase in COSS type losses will be worse than what I'm gaining by reducing this output resistance. I want to push somewhere in the vicinity of this knee, maybe a little above, a little below, depending on how bad my switching losses are, to reduce this output resistance and increase efficiency. And then I want to stop. Equivalently, I could also say, even if I neglect switching losses, if I'm way out here on switching frequency, I've got no benefit from going from FX to out here. What I could do instead is reduce my capacitance, change where this curve is, and get the same output resistance, shift RO up by using a smaller capacitance, have smaller physically, hopefully, capacitance in the circuit, and be able to get the same losses. Okay. So if I'm out here, either got higher switching losses or more capacitance than I need, or both of them, okay? The other problem will come in when we consider parasitic inductance, and this curve will start increasing again when we consider parasitic inductance, not designed to make it resonance, just what's in the circuit. Eventually this curve will start increasing again, okay? So I'll stop there for today. We'll pick up with this on Wednesday of next week. This Friday and Monday, again, will be these optional lectures related to layout, inductor selection, control for tiny box challenge. There's no need to log in. Those will just be posted as recordings that you can watch on your own time. Okay. So go ahead and stop recording.